I always had, I don't know if you have this problem too, when I was a kid and I would open those maps in my Bible, I had no idea like where in the world this place was. And there were usually the maps where you couldn't tell which part was land and which part was water, you know. It's the dark part land, it's the dark part water. So I start with this just to give you a little context. There's Italy, there is Northern Africa, there is Greece, there's Turkey. Here's where Jerusalem is. The region that we're going to be zooming in on here is what's known as Asia Minor. So this is Asia Minor. The city of Ephesus is right here. Okay? So this is where Ephesus is. It's in modern-day Turkey. Like I said, or like you said, many of you have been there already, so you know a little bit about Ephesus. Let's talk about just some general facts, some things that you should know or might be helpful to know about the city. So Ephesus in the first century. Why first century? This is when Paul was living. This is when things took place. In the first century, Ephesus had a population of about 250,000, which made it the third largest metropolitan area in the Mediterranean. Anybody want to guess what the one and two cities were, largest cities? Rome?
Athens?
Nope.
Thessalonica?
Think Africa.
Alexandria.
Rome and Alexandria were the first two, but Ephesus was the third. Being such a large city, it was the regional capital, so the whole area kind of focused there in Ephesus, so that also made it a government seat. So within the Roman world, the Roman government, there was political significance to the city of Ephesus. Also, being a seaport city, and being with such good access to the entire Mediterranean, which means you could go south to Africa, you could go west to Greece, you could go out eventually to the ocean, it made it an international seaport. So, with all these facts, what impact do you think that had on the city? Kind of taking all these things into consideration.
Center of influence.
Okay, center of influence, good. What type of people do you think lived in Ephesus?
Educated.
Okay, good. Wealthy people, educated people. Why wealthy?
Commerce,
right? If the ships are coming in and selling their stuff, there's going to be a lot of money. Why did you say intelligent?
Educated.
Why do you think educated? They did have a huge library. We're going to see some pictures of that.
Education centered in the cities.
Good. Yep. The cities were main education centers. Being a political capital meant a lot of the more educated people were there. Now, does that mean that everybody in the city was educated?
No.
No. Like most cities today, and especially most cities in the Roman world, there were all classes of people. And within the Roman world, the class system was very distinct. It was very clear who was rich and wealthy and educated, and who was poor and a slave most of the time and not very educated. Good. What else?
Cosmopolitan,
yeah. Yep. Being a major influential city meant the people were cosmopolitan, not rural farmer type people. How about ethnically? What do you think?
Mixed.
Mixed. Good. So Ephesus was known to have a lot of indigenous people living there. So the people who could trace their lineage way back to the Asia Minor area, but also it would have people from Greece that came over, Roman people, people from Africa, people from Egypt. It was a very diverse people group. There were also a fairly large Jewish population in the city of Ephesus in the first century. Now, all around the Roman world, there were pockets of Jews. Because of the diaspora, Jews were living all over the Mediterranean world. In some cities, their relationship with the other people in the city was fairly rocky and turbulent. In other cities, it was completely peaceful. In some places, it was somewhere in the middle. Does anybody know what happened in Rome in the year AD 49 to the Jews?
They were expelled by Claudius.
Yeah. So, this is one of my favorite stories in the first century. There's Jews in Rome, and at this point, this is AD 49, so this is post-Christ, okay? So there are also Christians in the city of Rome. But to a Roman, a run-of-the-mill Roman government worker, and they see these guys that are worshiping kind of in the same style and doing the same type of thing, they don't see any distinction between Christians and Jews. They're just all Jews. And so there's this great quote that says this happened in Rome. Since the Jews constantly made disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, he, the Emperor Claudius, expelled them from Rome. Who is Crestus? We've never heard of Crestus in the Bible, have you? Crestus sounds very similar to Christos, which is the word, the name of Christ. And so what most likely was happening here is that the Jews and the Christians were basically battling and arguing, like we see all throughout the book of Acts, about who is Christ, who is the Messiah, who was this Jesus character. Claudius had enough of it. He said, all right, all of you guys, just get out of here. You can't live here in the city. Now, eventually, they were allowed to come back. But there was this great expulsion of Jews from Rome. Ephesus wasn't really like that. There wasn't that tension. There wasn't that really extreme, maybe, distrust or hatred towards the Jews. However, what do you know about Jews in the ancient world? What were some things that maybe set them apart from the other peoples?
Their customs and their dress.
Good.
The Orthodox ones.
Good. Yep. So even still today, if you go to the Mediterranean world, you'll see Orthodox Jews. If you go to New York or Chicago, you'll see pockets of Orthodox Jews that physically are set apart. What else? What about some? You said some of their customs. What are some of the, maybe the customs of first century Jews? Keeping the Sabbath. What would be weird about that?
They wouldn't work.
It wouldn't work.
Their Sabbath was Saturday, and so...
Exactly. So when everybody else was working, the Jews did not work. Okay, so if you were a Jewish employee and it came to Saturday, your boss was probably not super excited that you were getting the day off at that point. Good. What else? What are some other maybe weird customs?
Dietary.
Food. Dietary customs. So they didn't do what?
No pork.
No pork. Yep. Shellfish, no cheeseburgers. That was a big bummer in the first century. What else?
Unclean people.
Yeah, good. Yeah, some groups of Jews became very looked down upon and maybe thought of as kind of uppity because they didn't want to come too close to the unclean. Yeah, good. Because then they would have to go wash and then they couldn't do all that stuff. Religiously, what's maybe another thing that would have set them apart in the Roman world?
The Jews didn't care for the Gentiles.
Okay, good. So there's a very clear distinction between other people groups and the Jews. They didn't really want to interact because of the uncleanliness. In turn, the Gentiles wouldn't want to interact with them.
Monotheistic.
That's a big one. What does that mean?
One God.
Which was different than what?
Triune Rome.
Yeah. Yeah, all of the other Roman people who worshipped many gods and had all of these different idols and different gods that they would worship, the Jews only worshipped one. We'll come back to that in a little bit. Good. So even though the Jews were not physically expelled from the city, and even though they weren't maybe discriminated against, there was still this stigma, right? There was still this thing that very clearly separated them from the rest of the people groups. There was this thing that maybe made them in some ways at an advantage and some ways at a disadvantage in commerce, in religion, in practicing what everyone else was doing in society, enough to make them very distinct. So there was a very clear and distinct Jewish population within the Roman world. Okay, we'll come back to that in just a sec when we start our tour of Ephesus. Well, I guess let's just start that now. We're going to look at a few of the major places that would have been standing in the first century, things that Paul would have seen and Paul would have interacted with and would have been around. And we'll start, and many of you who have been there, if you want to add to this, please feel free. We'll start with the Mosaeus Mithridates Gate. Now, this was the entry into the major commercial agora. So what's an agora?
A marketplace,
right? And you know what agoraphobia is? You ever heard of that? People who are fear of cramped, crowded places. Yeah. So this was the main entrance into the agora, to the main marketplace. This has an inscription on it from Emperor Caesar Augustus, which would place it to 4 BC, which means that this entry gate was almost certainly standing when Paul was visiting Athens, which, again, those of you who have been there, I imagine that's kind of a surreal feeling to see something to think of those characters in the Bible that were actually there walking through those gates. So what happens in the agora? What happens in the marketplace?
The men sit around talking.
Yeah, men sit around talking, and what do the women do? Shop for the country. It's a busy place, right? Then nothing's changed. Yeah, one of the city centers. Here's another picture of the gate. This is a main place where commerce would be happening, but more than commerce. There was a lot of culture that would be exchanged and be passed along through the marketplace. Those of you who have lived in cultures outside of the Western culture, I think this is still kind of a thing where there's a lot more that happens in marketplaces than just shopping and buying things. Good. So there is the Mithrat Gate. Now this is a road along the northern Agora. So this is not the exact same marketplace, but this is another road in Ephesus. And again, this is most likely standing in Paul's day. So those pillars all would have been there. Would have been a pretty amazing little walkway. You think your mall looks cool. This one is pretty fancy there. Notice how green and how lush it is. It's not, you know, this isn't the desert. This isn't the middle of nowhere, but this is a very green place. Remember, right along the river. Okay. Have you ever heard of the term Hellenism? You know what Hellenism is?
Greek-speaking
Jews.
Spread of Greece culture.
Yeah, spread of Greece culture. Okay, so you've heard of a guy named Alexander the Great, right? Alexander the Great was one of the greatest conquerors in human history. And so in the 300s BC, I guess would be more appropriate, Alexander the Great decided to go out, and he was going to conquer the world. So he went out from Greece and went all the way east to like India, south into Africa, north into like the middle of Europe. Like he went all out. He had a massive empire. One of the things that he wanted to do, he felt that being a Greek, that he was the holder of the most superior culture that the world has ever seen, Greek culture. Greek culture meant the Greek language. It meant a love for Greek entertainment, like the theater, the sports, doing sports naked, of course, because, you know, what other way should you do them? A love for Greek food, a love for Greek dress, a love for Greek names. So every city that he went to, when he conquered that city, not only did he say, hey, I'm the boss now, I'm the captain now, but he also began to influence that city and say, okay, you need to have a theater. You need to start doing these things. You need to start naming your people in Greek names. And so pretty soon, this idea of Hellenization or the spread of Greek culture was all over the world. So that's why in Jesus' day, it's the Roman world, right? But everyone's still speaking Greek. The architecture still looks Greek. And that's all because of Hellenization. So part of that meant the establishment of a theater. So here's the Civic Theater in Ephesus. Anybody, you've been there? Some of you have been there. Yeah, the Civic Theater in Ephesus. Does anybody know how many people could fit in the Civic Theater in Ephesus?
Is it 10,000?
More. About 25,000 people could fit in that city. So here's a picture. This is Craven Cottage. This is where Fulham Football Club plays in London. That fits about 25,000 people. Just to give you a comparison, because you know when you see a bunch of empty seats, it's like how many people can fit there. But that's a full soccer stadium that could fit in the Civic Theater here in Ephesus. Now remember this. Remember these pictures. Keep these in mind. I'm sure tomorrow Paul is going to make reference to this at some point. I guess you'll have to wait and see.
I'll have to know.
Now you have to. Yeah, so here's the Civic Theater in Ephesus, a major place where not only people would come to watch plays and that sort of thing, but this would be a place where there would be religious discussion, where some of the elders of the city would gather and they would make their decrees, and they would talk about things here in the Civic Theater. So 25,000 people. This is looking out to the seaport. So that is the Mediterranean out there. So pretty good view. It's not.
No, it's not anymore. It was.
Right.
It's all silted in.
Exactly, yeah. So this all, if you were able to see, it's brown. But in the first century, the ocean was, or the sea was up there. Yeah, but now it's all silt, and now it's probably smells bad, I would imagine.
It takes like 20, it's like 20 miles from the port.
To walk all the way down to where the water is, yeah.
So that picture was taken on
recent, yeah, this is a first century photograph. Recent picture, yeah. Good. So there's the Civic Theater in Ephesus. Let's go on to, here's what Becky, oh no, this is, I wanted to mention this. Okay, so this is an inscription that's found in the city of Ephesus of a gladiator. Now there's not a lot of direct literature that tells us that gladiators fought in Ephesus. But the fact that there's this inscription here makes a lot of people believe that there was gladiator battles in Ephesus. Where would they probably be? In the civic theater, okay? So not only would, or what would, you guys have all seen pictures and movies of gladiators, right? They fight one another. There's also gladiators who fight against wild beasts, right? Against lions and tigers and bears. We knew where we were going there, right? So again, interesting. If you know a little bit about some of the writings of Paul, maybe that has something to say to you. But perhaps there were gladiators fighting in the city of Ephesus. Okay, now the library. This is the library that Becky mentioned. Now, the thing about this is this library dates to about 110 AD. So this is after the time of Paul, but I just think it looks really cool, so I wanted to show you. So this is a pretty nice looking library with original floodlights. From I bet they didn't have extension cords problems back then, right? Good, so that's the library. Okay, here's a couple pictures of a recent discovery in the city of Ephesus. These are the terraced homes in Ephesus that date from all the way to like the 1st century BC to the 7th century AD. So this one, these look pretty nice. I would imagine these are a little bit later. These might not be first century homes, but there's some homes very similar to this that date before the time that Paul was there. So it's very likely that this is the type of home that Paul would have been familiar with, that the people in Ephesus in the first century would have been around. Very beautiful. You know, a lot of, at least for me, a lot of times when I think of anything before like 1960, I think of it basically like a cave, you know, with a couple candles. But it's a reminder of the beauty of architecture that was a part of these societies way before. And imagine this, like if we were to build this thing today, we would be using electric cement mixers, we would be using electric levels, we would be using trucks to bring the materials where we needed it to be. This was stuff that was all done manually, all done by hand. The craftsmanship that was needed to create these type of buildings and these architecture and the columns that we see, and we'll see a few more columns in a little bit, is just pretty amazing. Okay, now, let's get to, we're going to finish in this next 20-25 minutes by talking about probably the main culturally significant element of the city of Ephesus, and that is this lady. This is an idol of the goddess Artemis. So in every city, we talked about the pluralistic understanding of the multi-gods that people had all throughout the Greek and Roman world. Ephesus was no different. There was a whole bunch of different gods, but there was one god or goddess who was not even comparable to the other gods as far as the Ephesian understanding of who this goddess was and what this goddess did for them. And this was the goddess Artemis. Artemis, the other name for Artemis, does anybody know what the other name for Artemis is?
Diana.
Okay, but here's the thing. If you were to go online and Google image search Diana or goddess Diana, you would get a picture of an idol or a carving much different than this. It would be a young woman, very beautiful. She would usually have a bow with her and like probably similar, a little fawn or something by her. The goddess Diana that was known throughout the Roman world and the Greek world was a different goddess than what the Ephesians called Diana of Ephesus or Artemis of Ephesus. As you can see, Artemis of Ephesus is not well, maybe by our standards, not the most attractive looking thing, but she played a huge part in this, and I don't know how to get to what I need to do here. So, the origins of Artemis of Ephesus. Like I said, this isn't the same god. this goddess, was actually a goddess of the indigenous people, the people who originally founded the city of Ephesus, like back in like the 8th century BC. So like way, way, way before, this was who this goddess was. There's some understanding that they thought she fell from the sky and that the original Artemis was carved out of a meteorite that fell, and so she's known as someone who just kind of appeared in that city. And so the original people adopted her as this goddess, and she was a fertility goddess. Do you know a little bit about fertility gods and fertility goddesses? Are you embarrassed to talk about it? What was kind of the job or the duty of a fertility goddess?
Bless you with children.
Okay, so there's a personal element to it, right? That this was the goddess, especially of women in childbirth, that she would safely help to deliver the children. But there's a bigger understanding of what a fertility god or goddess would do.
Make the land fertile.
Exactly. They would provide for the land. They would make sure that things grew. And again, this is a world before being able to drive 35 minutes to go to Walmart, you know, when you run out of bananas. Probably didn't have a lot of bananas in first century Ephesus, but this was a world where you had to live on what the land provided. And so if the land didn't provide, you didn't live, okay? And so they would worship these fertility goddesses as not only personally providing for them and their families, but providing for the city as a whole. So Artemis was a fertility goddess. Now, part of the worship of a fertility goddess or a fertility god was almost ingrained, not out of choice, right? So I don't worship these gods because I want to, because I choose to, but you worship this god so that your city will live, which meant you had essentially a civic duty to worship these gods. If you didn't worship the god of Artemis and your city all of a sudden came into a drought, whose fault was it? Your fault, right? You're the one who's at fault. And so by not worshiping these gods and goddesses, you were essentially putting your city at risk. So this was something that everybody had to do, and this was everything that somebody did. So the temple of Artemis. I think there's a choir. Yeah, if anybody's in the choir, that's now. So 4:15, head on out. The temple of Artemis, because she was such a central goddess to that city, they built a temple to her in the city of Ephesus. The Temple of Artemis became known as one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Anybody know any of the other ones? I don't know if I do, so Colossus. Your guess is a good one. Colossus, good.
The Lighthouse of the Gardens in Babylon.
Yeah, Babylon Gardens.
The Lighthouse in Alexandria.
Lighthouse in Alexandria. Like I said, you could say anything right now and I'd agree with you.
Roman Colosseum.
Roman Colosseum, good, I like it. The Space Needle. Right? So it was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Now, obviously, this is not its original state. Okay, these are the ruins of the Temple of Artemis. We'll get to in a second what that would have looked like. But this was built in the 400s BC was the original, was the, or the 400, yeah, the 400 AD. No. The 7th century BC is when it was originally built. So way back when they first found the Artemis statue. It was destroyed four times between then and 400 BC when it was destroyed for the last time. So the temple would be destroyed, and then they would rebuild it. Why would they rebuild it? Because Artemis was their god. She was the goddess who was providing for them. A unique thing about Artemis, again, is while there was an understanding that the gods of Rome and the gods of Greece kind of protected everybody, and you could worship this god in Rome or whatever, they viewed Artemis of Ephesus as their own god. She was only responsible for them. She didn't have to look after or care for anybody else. She only had to care about Ephesus. It was this very personal relationship that they had. A personal relationship with Artemis. That's funny. Okay, so let's look at some pictures of perhaps what it would have looked like. Here's the Parthenon. Where is that?
Athens.
Okay, so you could still go and see the Parthenon today. This would be very similar to what the temple to Artemis would have looked like, except it would have been smaller. This is smaller than the temple to Artemis. The temple to Artemis would have had, I think, 128 columns, something like 220 by 460 feet, 60 foot high. just this absolutely beautiful thing. Here's not a photograph of what the Temple of Artemis would have looked like in Paul's day. So again, just imagine this. You're in Ephesus in the first century. You're walking through the city and you see all of these people going to this magnificently beautiful temple. A temple that was built together with the people. There's probably very specific cornerstones throughout the city, or throughout the temple, that you could see, as this was the first stone that was put there. They would have a festival of Artemis once a year, in which the people would take their little Artemis statues and they would form a parade, and they would walk through the streets of the city, they would walk through the homes, they would walk through the theater, then they would walk through the temple, and while they're doing this, they'd be singing songs, saying things like, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians, great is Artemis of the Ephesians," and they would have this great triumphant procession all throughout the city, and this was a very important thing that happened every year. Another part of this festival is that it was a time for young men and women who were not married to be looking for that special someone. You know, love was in the air during the festival of Artemis. Why? Fertility goddess, right? All about that sort of thing. Because this thing was so beautiful, because it was known around the ancient world, Ephesus became a tourist location. It's on the seaport. It's already a busy, important place. But now you have people that are coming specifically to see Artemis, right? For them, they worship all these gods anyways. Might as well go and worship Artemis of the Ephesians while they're in town. They got to see this place. It's kind of like when you're driving through South Dakota, you go to Mount Rushmore because you really need a break from driving through South Dakota, right? Or there's places that you will go. Maybe you'll even travel to a different country or different state specifically to see a landmark. You know, some people will go to Washington, D.C. to see these specific buildings in these specific places. Those aren't quite the same sort of thing as a temple to Artemis, quite. But this is what would happen. People in the first century, or up until the fourth century, would travel throughout the world to come here to see Artemis. And of course, when you go to the see the, what are those faces? Mount Rushmore. You leave. Where are you ushered through on your way out?
The gift shop.
And what do?
You buy
your own Mount Rushmore to bring home and remember. I saw. Or you see. We love those postcards, right? Mount Rushmore in the dark. You ever seen those? Just black.
No.
Mount Rushmore in the dark. So, very similar thing would happen when you came to Ephesus and when you left Ephesus. You wanted to maybe remember your trip, or you wanted to take part of that. Maybe you enjoyed the worship here. You saw the splendor of this place, and you say, "Wow, maybe that's a cool thing. I'll add Artemis to my collection." So, what would you do? You'd buy a little idol. Okay. So tourists were buying these idols, but also, like we said, it was a civic responsibility to worship Artemis. If you didn't worship Artemis, you were letting down the city of Ephesus, and so. Unless you were a Jew or a Christian, you were almost certainly worshiping Artemis in your home. And how did you worship Greek and Roman gods in your home? You bought an idol, right? So you would buy a little something like that. And you would bring this idol of Artemis and you would put it in your home. A lot of times fertility gods were placed in the bedroom for obvious reasons. This was a common thing. Again, if you were not a Jew or a Christian and you went into somebody's home, or if you went into a home of somebody who wasn't a Jew or Christian, you were almost completely guaranteed to see multiple statues of the goddess Artemis in those cities or in those houses. And so we see that Artemis is not just, you know, another god. You know, this isn't just like Zeus or whatever. But she played an absolutely central role in the life of that city, in the economics of that city. Why? How does she play a role in the economics of the city? Yeah, so they're selling these statues. What else?
Materials.
Yeah, materials to build them, to build the temple.
The craftsmen.
People are coming, tourists, right? They're coming, and when you're in Ephesus, what do you got to do? Got to go to the Motel 6, right?
Corn dogs.
Get corn dogs, turkey legs, right? Right. So there's tourism that's happening. So there's economics. How does this affect the religion of the city? Pretty obvious. How does Artemis have an impact on the religion of the city? Everybody worshipped her, right? She was the defining goddess of the city. How about just normal cultural interactions? Do you think there is there any impact that she would have? Hey, did you hear that he didn't pray to Artemis last night? Yeah. Rumors start. They talk about Artemis. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's a good one. Yeah. Exactly. So she was absolutely central. And so when you think about Ephesus in the ancient world, you have to think about Artemis. If you miss out on her, you're missing a completely key and cornerstone element of the Ephesian culture. When we read in the next few days in the book of Acts, you'll see Paul interact, and I'm sure you're familiar with these passages. You see Paul interacting with Artemis on a very intense level, the people following Artemis, the people worshiping Artemis. As we read through Paul's letter, and I think Jerry tonight will probably talk about some of the imagery of building and cornerstones and built together and all of that stuff. As we do that and as you read that, think about these things that the people in Ephesus would have been intimately familiar with these buildings, with the worship of the gods. When we talk, when Paul talks about how Christ makes the two people one, how he brings them together and destroys the dividing wall of hostility, remember that there was a unique pocket of Jewish people who had unique customs and had unique beliefs that was a dividing wall between them and the rest of the culture. A lot of times when we read that passage, and I don't know who's preaching on that, so I don't want to steal their thunder, we think of in the temple in Jerusalem. Maybe you've heard this. There's a wall that basically says, if you're a Gentile and you go beyond this wall and you die, it's not our fault. We warned you. Good luck. And so Gentiles could not go beyond that wall, and so you couldn't fully worship God if you were a Gentile, if you hadn't gone, become a proselyte and become an actual Jew. And so a lot of times people think that's what Paul is referring to. I don't think he is, because I don't think the people in Ephesus would have been super familiar with the temple in Jerusalem. But what they would have been familiar with is the wall of hostility that being a Jew in a culture of pluralistic people who worshipped all these gods, who focused on Artemis and looked down on people who didn't worship Artemis. So I think that that's kind of what Paul is getting at when he talks about that. But by understanding the city, by understanding what was going on in the first century, by understanding what the city looked like, by understanding what the people thought was important and what the people valued, we begin to unlock what Paul is trying to communicate in this letter and in his interactions in the city. So does anybody have any questions or thoughts or comments about any of this stuff?
Did they pray to the...
They did. They would pray to Artemis, yeah. Very regularly. It would be part of their daily, multiple time a day type thing.
Is there a reason why the pillar, I mean, you talked about 60 foot tall. Mm-hmm. Was it to emphasize the goddesses being
a numerology? I don't think there was anything specific. At least I haven't read that. I think it was just, we want to make the biggest, most beautiful thing that we can possibly think of because Artemis is great. Becky?
Paul mentions that Paul was a tent maker there, mm-hmm. and with Priscilla and Aquila. Mm-hmm. So would that mean maybe they were just sort of outside the city or living in the... slaves wouldn't sleep in the tents, I don't suppose. I don't know.
I would think that those would be things that would be sold in a marketplace rather than creating them to live in.
Where would they be putting tents, I wonder, in a developed city?
Well, I think, and I got this idea from Phil Long, so you can blame him, that perhaps Paul got his citizenship through his parents or his grandparents who perhaps made tents and sold them to the Roman government and the Roman army, because the military used tents. And so oftentimes if you would do business with the government, you could theoretically be given citizenship as payment. And so I think that the tents were probably not necessarily used in the city, but they would be used by the military, they'd be used by...
For export. Or
right, exactly. Yep. Yeah.
Was she considered to be like a savior? They didn't have any concept of savior.
Well, she was considered to be the one who kept their city alive. And without her, their city would fall apart, everything would die. So in a way, I think a savior term, a savior idea would probably be appropriate.
Do you know what date approximately that, you know, through the silt or whatever, it did sort of fill in and become landlocked, and so of course the commerce would start to come down?
This,
or what caused
the city to kind of... Yeah, I think it was just kind of the end of the Roman Empire was a big part of it, and so... you know, that was whenever in the 600s, 700s or so, I think, when it started to crumble. I mean, when the fact that they didn't rebuild the temple in 400 meant that it was already, you know, at the point where worshiping Artemis maybe wasn't as important of a thing because, you know.
What we heard is that people died off health-wise.
Good, okay.
The silting in of everything caused infestation of mosquitoes
and malaria.
Malaria and
any idea of the date?
Thousands of
Huh? Any idea of the date?
No.
Okay. Did you hear that?
That's what we were.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
Where was Artemis when the mosquitoes were biting?
That's true. They didn't worship her enough.
All Paul's fault.
So one last thing before we end here. If you are interested in learning more about Ephesus as a city, here's just a couple resources you can check out. This is a really great commentary series. Even if you're not a pastor or a teacher or, you know, if you just like studying the Bible and like learning about culture and history, Zondervan has put out, it's a 4-part series for the New Testament and a 5-part series for the Old Testament called the Zondervan Illustrated Bible Background Commentary. And it just deals with what Paul makes this reference to. You know, a house. What would a house look like in Philippi or something like that? You can buy them individually, so you can buy them book by book, but it's cheaper if you buy the whole set. So that's a great one. And then this commentary, I'm sure the other guys will have different opinions, but in my opinion, this is, I have felt to be the most helpful commentary on Ephesians by a guy named Harold Honer, an exegetical commentary. This is a little bit deeper, so if you want a little bit of a challenge in working through some stuff, but he spends... In a very good section dealing with the origins of the city of Ephesus, the origins of Artemis, the origins of the culture of the city before he even dives into the commentary. So this is a great one. It's a big boy, so you know, you get it and you reference it every now and then. But those are a couple resources if you're interested in learning more about the city of Ephesus. Another great resource, those of you who are over a certain age will laugh, but Wikipedia.com. Go to Wikipedia, search Artemis of the Ephesians, search Ephesus. You'll learn a ton of stuff, and it's almost all correct. Contrary to popular belief, I think like 98% of the stuff on Wikipedia is accurate. So check it out. There's a lot of good information on there, pictures and all that stuff. Google image search, there's lots of good stuff there. Maybe don't Google image search Artemis as if you make sure you have a filter on. Yeah.
We were asking about whether she was worshipped in Rome.
Well, the one that would be worshipped in Rome would be the other Artemis, the other Diana, who would be the born arrow woman. Yeah. But she specifically, she'd be worshipped by people who visited and came back, but she specifically would only be in Ephesus. Anything else?
Yeah. I think, Jim, the way you started with the context, I think Paul's probably going to cover when he goes to the Ephesians, the Acts passage. The response in that passage of the people that we all know, and you referenced it, Artemis fell from heaven. So that gives a real clue to if Paul's going to reach these people. Here's what they think, where God comes from.
Exactly.
So the gap of what he has to tell them about this God, who is so dramatically different, if they've historically inherited that time after time, it's more like almost the Orient of Japan or China, of thinking that this is the way we've always done, and we inherited it. And that gap is enormous for him to explain about a God who created this world and sent his son.
Yeah.
And really a humongous gap.
Yeah, and I think in Ephesus, it's even more so than other places because they are still so connected with their ancient roots. And this is not just the imported gods of Alexander, but this is a God that goes back to the 7th century, much more primitive, which creates that gap. Yeah, that's a great observation.